granting to in terms of tenure here?
Yeah, this is not the first time we've seen this either. UNC lost a major grant after its debacle over the Silent Sam Confederate monument on its campus and how it handled that. And it continues to come into conflict with major donors and to lose donors and money from individuals who donate to the school, to which, honestly, some of the folks who are running the school and running the university say, okay, that's fine. We're doing what it is we want to do, and we believe that we'll, continue to find the money to do that. But we're not interested in changing direction because these people who fund our work don't like how we're managing things.
Students toppled the statue, the Confederate statue, in 2018. Now the UNC press is in the crosshairs of the Board of Governors, which is refusing to reappoint Professor Eric Mueller, who criticized the handling of the Silent Sam statue. We have 5 seconds.
Yeah, Eric Mueller is a renowned UNC law professor who has been on the UNC press board for 2 terms. He was
3 seconds.
Expected to be reappointed, was not reappointed, and has butted heads with the Board of Governors.
We'll leave it there. Joe Killian, thanks for joining us.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
And at KBOO Portland, it's Wednesday morning. It's 8 a.m. It's time for Wednesday Talk Radio with your host, Paul Rowland. Stay tuned to your community connection.
Give me back my broken night, my mirrored room, my secret. Life is lonely here. There's no one left to torture. Give me absolute control over every other living soul and lie beside me, baby. That's an order. Give me cracking anal sex. Take the only tree that's left and stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me back the Berlin Wall. Give me Stalin. Give me St. Paul. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
It is murder. Yeah.
Good morning, everybody. It is me, Paul Rowan, live in the KBOO studios. Hooray. It's so good to be back here after all these months. We did try it a few months back, and then things got really hot again, so we had to close it down. But anyway, here I am, and I'm glad to be here. Glad to be here with Sonia, my board operator, and talking at you and with you, hopefully with you, 503-231-8187. So, yeah, I know it's cooled off a lot, and that's good because it was hot. And I know I've talked a lot about the hot, but I've got to. All right, enough alliteration. Yeah, the pandemic is easing, at least here in the country. It's exploding many, many places around the world. It could really explode again here, too, if we get, a Delta Plus variant that starts to elude our vaccination efforts. But I don't want to be too much of a doomsayer. But, you know, these things are possible. So I'm actually reconsidering going back to masking up in indoor, at least in indoor spaces in public, because, this Delta variant has got me rather concerned. But anyway, so yeah, I wanted to not let everybody off the hook and just avoid difficult discussions. Of course, faithful listeners to Wednesday Talk Radio know that I don't avoid difficult questions, but I'm going to keep talking about the heat dome, the heat wave, and climate change. Because, folks, it's not going away. In fact, it's likely to get worse. Do you realize that this is what's happening under just over 1 degree Celsius heating globally? The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is basically assuming a 2 degree. We have to keep it under 2 degrees. So this is what's happening with just over 1 degree. You know, and let it get through our heads. These sound like relatively small changes, but they have enormous, enormous impacts. All right, so I'm going to read from a few articles. I'd like to engage you further in conversation, but what I'd really like to talk about, I'll just throw out the question now before I start reading from some stuff, just to get you thinking. So, you know, I think it's going to be really, really grim. I think it's going to be grimmer than any of us have really allowed ourselves to think about. I don't think our institutions globally, nationally, are really capable of confronting what's coming at us really fast. I really don't. But I'm prepared to be, have my mind changed, to be pleasantly surprised. You know, some people think that it's going to take really, really bad things happening continually, as if they haven't been already, to really, you know, make us, wake us up or something like that. I actually think it might be the contrary, that, you know, when these kind of things really start grinding in on us, it's going to be, paralysis is might be the more likely scenario. So anyway, so yeah, we do have to act now. I'm not willing to just give up. I'm not willing to just say, hey, you know, we're going to be fried and let's just live our lives out. No, I don't know. I've been an activist most of my adult life, so I guess that's how I'm oriented. I think what we need is more action. The best antidote to despair is action, as they say. So what could we do here in Portland, in Oregon, in the Pacific Northwest, specifically, because that's the bulk of our audience, are some people listening online. Appreciate you, too. And of course, everybody needs to act where they are. But what could we do that would truly shake things up, that would truly resonate locally, nationally, globally, to around, you know, to really have the kind of impact on people's minds, hearts, and actions, possibly, to make, you know, something that's replicable, that serves as an inspiration, as a model. And I know we've done a lot of that. We've shut down a lot of export facilities. You know, think back to that Greenpeace action, which, you know, was largely symbolic. But those people hanging from the bridge, the St. John's Bridge, when was that? 3 years ago? I don't know. Time flies. And to stop that, I believe it was a Shell Oil ship that works on oil rigs. And that went around the world. That inspired people. I think a lot of our activism here in the Pacific Northwest has inspired a lot of other people around the country to keep on fighting, you know, that it is possible to shut down large infrastructure projects. I know a lot of people from the Pacific Northwest have participated in the Dakota Access Pipeline actions, contributed to that. So yeah, we can do all those things, but you know what? How do we take it up a few notches? It really does need to go up. I talked about being at the Chase Bank a few weeks back and, you know, doing a protest outside, which was, you know, somewhat empowering for us. It didn't get much attention. I don't know how much it resonated with people around us. But, you know, what sort of things? You know, I'm constrained from, like, doing what they call calls to actions to, you know, inciting people to take direct actions. But, you know, I could suggest things. I don't know. I wonder what would happen if, for example, all the Chase Bank locations in Portland or in the region were all simultaneously occupied. And, you know, with the intention of staying there as long as people could, with people outside, you know, a ring of people 10 thick, you know, outside the doors blocking, you know, the police. I don't know. What would happen? For example, I've long said that, you know, I think that possibly large scale, what we used to call monkey wrenching actions, the old Earth First days, just, you know, sabotage would be, you know, I always thought that it would be interesting if, for example, you know, instead of that one poor woman who was sentenced to, what, 12 years in prison? I can't remember her name, just sentenced to 12 years in prison in Iowa for having sabotaged parts of the Keystone Pipeline. Anyway, somebody correct me. I can look that up. And 12 years. She's facing 12 years in prison. So what would have happened if, you know, instead of one, it was 1,000 or 10,000 or 50,000 people were doing something like that? You know, I know these are massive organizing challenges. I'm one lone soul talking into the wind, into the microphone here at KBOO, into the airwaves. But yeah, I mean, are we just gonna let this climate change juggernaut just continue along its not so merry way? I'd rather not. I see the problems as being in the global financial capitalist system, which continue to finance large scale projects, which require the fossil fuels, you know, whether it's the tar sands, whether it's regular oil, whether it's frack gas, whether it's whatever, require them to be continued to be taken out of the ground and burned in order to recoup their investment. It's built in to the financial speculative capitalist system. So how do we, realistically attack that? I mean, people, you know, divestment are really, you know, interesting. You know, that's had a certain success, certain resonance around the world. You know, I believe countries like Norway have taken some stand against, long-term extraction of fuels. So yeah, big pools of capital withdrawing that from the fossil fuel system, the climate chaos system. That's interesting. You know, I think certainly unions need to put pressure on their where their pension funds are. But, you know, all this requires organizing from the ground up generally, because, you know, it's not it tends to be not the corporations themselves. We heard, if you heard Democracy Now, was it yesterday, where they had those Exxon executives, former Exxon lobbyists, telling all to the Greenpeace people who are posing as corporate headhunters and saying, "Oh yeah, yeah, we hid the science. We did everything we could to prevent any kind of change towards renewables. We, you know, whatever. If you heard that, that's the corporations are so locked into that. There are some that at least are making, you know, seem to be making shifts towards renewable energy. I don't trust it. I think large-scale centralized renewables is not the way to go. It's smaller-scale, community-controlled. Trusting the corporations to do anything. What we need to do is, you know, get the resources that the corporations have basically expropriated from all of us on the planet and used to build up vast amounts of political and economic power to continue doing what they're doing. Somehow we need to do that. So, you know, direct action is a way that's proved successful in certain circumstances. So simultaneously with what could we do in Portland that would most resonate across the country and around the world, what are the most powerful collective actions you've been involved in that could serve as sort of models for, you know, what is actually possible? All right. Actually, we already got Sherry and Rob, so maybe I shouldn't start reading from this article. Scientists call Northwest heatwave the most extreme in world weather records. I will read some from that because people really need to know how dramatic and how extraordinary, not to people who really have been studying this, it wasn't that much of a surprise, but how extraordinary that what happened to us just a week ago really was. So, Sherry, let's just listen to what Sherry has to say. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hi. You mentioned the word expropriation. Is that the word expropriated, that they expropriated? But, you know, really, I think we have given them a lot of power, primarily with our purchasing decisions. And while it's not a collective action in the sense of doing a protest and a boycott, which I do, and are fun and empowering and build community, each of us make daily decisions every day as to who we give our money to. So, like when you were talking about being at Chase Bank, I was like, he goes to Chase Bank? What's he doing? And I realized then, no, you were doing a protest. But I mean, if you're with Bank of America, you're empowering Bank of America. If you buy anything off of Amazon, you're empowering Amazon. If you're with AT&T, you're empowering these like uber right wing, you know, awful corporations. So I think the thing to do is to, I don't know, maybe we could develop support groups for people to feel like we're in solidarity. But I'm just, in many ways, I feel like I'm a lone protester by my decision to boycott Amazon. I mean, I've never given Amazon a dime. I will never give them money, ever.
Well, so, I'm with you on that. I refuse to use Amazon myself. And my money's in a credit union, and you know I could list all the things. So I think I've basically done what you're talking about for much of my adult life. You know, I do more the more I become conscious, and yeah, right. I think encouraging people to do the same. My, you know, I don't know if you listen to the show much, but what I harp on a lot, and I stand by it, is that I think we're beyond the time when the individual decisions, voluntary individual actions are actually going to add up, are going to have the power in the time that's needed to make the changes that are needed. I think those are just fundamental. Yeah, we need to, at every protest, we need to say those things and encourage people to do those things. We need to talk about that on KBOO. We need to talk about it with our friends and family. Sure, totally. But I think we need much more than that. So that's why I believe in, you know, collective resistance and collective action of a kind that, you know, like when I got involved with Earth First, no one thought that we could actually stop or slow down logging in the Pacific Northwest on a large scale. No one had any idea. We just, this few people, you know, first, you know, hugging trees and then sitting down in roads and then locking down to equipment or whatever. And it turned out that, you know, we got a year plus moratorium on all logging on national lands. And we got the Northwest Forest Plan, which was flawed and limited, but did slow down, you know, it instituted the kinds of changes that, you know, most environmentalists didn't think were possible just 5 or 10 years before. And that was just really started with just a relatively few number of people and had, so I'm looking for those kinds of things. I think it's possible. And I think we've seen that kind of thing.
Well, I wasn't necessarily insinuating that you weren't doing those things. I just think, in general, I still think that there are many, many, many activists and many people who would otherwise care who just buy things from Amazon because it's convenient or cheap. And I just think that many, many, many of us need to walk our talk. I mean, I'm an organic farmer, and there are many organic farmers who don't even buy organic. So, I mean, you know, there's always, even within our own people, I actually had the privilege of picking David Brower up from the airport once about 25 years ago when he was in Portland, and I said something about, well, isn't that preaching to the choir? And he said, there is no choir. And I think that's kind of what he was referring to, is that so many of us, we mean one thing, or, you know, and I am no perfectionist, I'm no queen, I still drive a fossil fuel car, you know, we're all on our own path, but I think increasing the awareness and, you know, avoiding packaging as much as possible, every one of us, you know, it's the production of plastic in so many ways. So I just still think there's a lot of individual work that needs to be done, because on one hand, I agree that the corporations have just incredible, immense power, they do that because people keep buying their products.
Well, I would think they do that because capitalism allows them to do that. It's a capitalist system, and capitalism developed because people expropriated the economic power from people, you know, from individual farmers back in, say, England, you know, people who mm-hmm. were growing their own, you know, had their own animals and were shearing their own wool and then you know, weaving it themselves. And so the, you know, the first large-scale capitalist enterprises were, you know, textile mills, for example, and they basically took what was the provenance, the independent sustenance of individual families and took it and enclosed the commons and took away people's ability to raise their own sheep and to basically, you know, make their own lives, livelihoods. And that's what the capitalist system has done. Capitalism means just the ability to have capital, which is machinery. Uh-huh. And machinery has been run by fossil fuels, and it's, you know, it just spins off new. And so we have to change that system ultimately. And how do we attack that system? And I'm not disagreeing with anything you're saying. I totally agree. That I'm just saying, if I think we have to understand how fast climate change is happening, and if it's actually possible for those individual choices to add up to what's needed to change it. I say it's not, and I don't know how we can actually come to a common understanding over whether that's true or not, but I think it's really crucial to actually look at what's actually
right.
happening.
And obviously some decisions are going to have a bigger impact than others. I feel that even with the weaknesses of the organic program, with the Organic Production Act and the laws that weakened a little bit, not unlike the forest plan, I think if everyone decided tomorrow they're going to 90% of what they eat is going to be organic, that would make a big difference to the climate, because conventional agriculture is hell, and on the earth, on the planet, on animals, on our health. And
well, of course, but if
that
people
would, that
if,
would be
if we haven't shifted thing. if we haven't shifted, if let's look at, okay, one way to look at it is, okay, what are the percentages of increase in both organic buying and organic food production over the past 30 years, 20 years, 40 years, 50 years, and look and see if that matches, you know, if to get to like 60 or 70 or 80 or 90%, how long would it take based on the current trajectory? So if it's going to be, you know, 50 years down the line, then obviously something else has to happen. That us talking about the radio is not going to make that happen. So that's all I'm saying is the cumulative impact of the kinds of changes on the basis of individual choices is, in my opinion, is just so far from matching the speed at which the climate is changing right now before us. So I just don't see it happening. But anyway, we may disagree, or we could have further conversations, but thanks for calling in, Sherry.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the talk.
Bye. All right. So before we go to our next caller at 503-231-8187, God, it's so cool to be talking into a live microphone. I think my voice quality is probably better than on my telephone, and it's just so much more immediate. Anyway, so this is a scientist called Northwest Heatwave, the most extreme in world weather records. That's pretty dramatic. A pair of climate scientists on Thursday, this is from July 2, said the record high temperatures that have ravaged the northwestern U.S. and western Canada over the past week, killing hundreds and sparking dozens of wildfires, represent the world's most extreme heat wave in modern history. Quote, never in the century-plus history of world weather observation has so many all-time heat records fallen by such a large margin than in the past week's historic heat wave in western North America, meteorologist Bob Henson and former National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administrator hurricane scientist Jeff Masters wrote for Yale Climate Connections. Quote, it's not hype or exaggeration to call the past week's heat wave the most extreme in world weather records, they argued. The only heat wave that compares is the Great Dust Bowl heat wave of July 1936 in the U.S. Midwest and South Central Canada. But even that cannot compare to what happened in the Northwest U.S. and Western Canada over the past week. In British Columbia, the chief coroner said her office has received nearly 500 reports of, quote, sudden and unexpected deaths since last Friday, many of which are believed to be connected to the record temperatures that the region has suffered in recent days. Residents of the small British Columbia village of Lytton, which on Tuesday reached Canada's all-time high temperature of 121 degrees Fahrenheit, were forced to evacuate Wednesday as a wildfire ripped through the area and quickly engulfed the small town, destroying homes and buildings. Henson and Masters called Lytton, 90% of which was burned, the poster community of the horrific heat wave. Weather historian Christopher Burt told the two scientists that, quote, this is the most anomalous regional extreme heat event to occur anywhere on Earth since temperature records began. Nothing can compare, Burt added. And then it goes on to cite specific records broken in Portland, Quileute, Washington, et cetera. So this is a scientist called Northwest Heatwave, the most extreme in world weather records, by Jake Johnson, a staff writer at Common Dreams. And that's one article I wanted to cite. Have several others, but I think we have at least one caller. Rob, go ahead. You're on the air, Rob.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to add a little tidbit to... You were talking about Jessica Resnick. I always mess up her last name. You have an interesting tidbit about that. So she did get sentenced to 8 years. I currently live, you know, here in the Pacific Northwest in the Portland area. I'm actually from Southeast Iowa, and that's where the Dakota Access Pipeline, the Keystone, was, I believe, in the Dakotas. This is from a company, I believe, in Houston, Texas. But the interesting story is the last farm that they were going through using eminent domain was a good friend of mine that I grew up with, and his father has homesteaded that farm. You know, instead of cutting down all the trees like all the other people did, he planted trees. He has, you know, rare bats that roost in the trees. So he's really been taking care of, you know, being a steward to the land. So the interesting part is, I don't know if you read about this, it came out probably in, I think, maybe 2015, 16. They were trying to gain access to the, he was the last one in the line, and he said no. And it was right up, they had to go through the, they're right on the Mississippi River, and he said, no, I won't sell a blade of grass for $1 million. Well, come to find out, the he was visited by these two oil executives from Dakota Access Pipeline, and they offered him, and he has it on audio recording, his son happens to be a very crafty studio engineer, and he wired him up. These two gentlemen offered him two 18-year-old prostitutes, $2,000 apiece, take him to St. Louis, and, you know, make his wildest dreams come true sort of thing. I guess they thought he was just some no-good hick. Well, he had got this on audio, and he took it to the DA. He had evidence, I mean, just that would, you know, that, I mean, to me, human trafficking, that's a big issue, right? It kind of makes me sick to my stomach that Jessica, who worked alongside Huey Tweedy, is the farmer's name, my friend's dad, worked alongside with him, and, you know, they gave her a place to stay when she wasn't camping, that sort of thing, and, you know, they helped each other out. I think there was about 100 to 300 people a day out there, you know, protesting. But these guys got off scot-free, even though he had evidence, and yet this peaceful protester, Jessica's trying to do the right thing, gets sentenced 8 years in prison. That just, you know, makes me sick to my stomach.
I'll say. Wow. Well, yes. Thank you for, just for the fact that I didn't get her name, and I got the pipeline wrong, and I got her sentence all wrong. And just for that, I'm so glad you called in. But that's amazing that you have that direct connection to that story. That's
it's a pretty sad story. But if you are interested in reading, I think actually it was covered on a couple mainstream news media, but it didn't get much. It got wiped away pretty quickly because we know these big corporations have a lot of play and a lot of lobbying in the media, that sort of thing. But yeah, his name is Huey Tweedy, and if you're interested in reading that story, you can look it up. There's still some headlines about it, and very interesting how these guys just, you know, got away scot-free when, you know, they're trying to.
Yeah, I think the name is Energy Transfer Partners or something like that.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Out of Houston. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but yeah. Anyway, good show, and I'm enjoying it. And I enjoy that's an interesting tidbit about the heat wave, and definitely concerning. And but yeah, I just want to add that tidbit, and if your listeners are interested in looking it up, and, you know, I hope Jessica can hopefully, you know, get up, I don't know how that works, get out on parole or whatever, but it's just, you see these people every day that are doing, you know, horrendous crimes or doing, you know, doing things that you see that should be, you know, legitimately going, you know, maybe sentenced or whatever. I'm not a big fan of people in cages, but especially not peaceful protesters, so.
All right. Well, thank you so much for that. I appreciate that.
All right.
Contribution.
Thank you, sir.
All right. We've had a couple good callers looking for others. It's halfway through the program. It's 8:31 in the morning here at KBOO Community Radio. I can now say in our studios here in inner southeast Portland, right off Burnside and right near the Willamette River, I'm Paul Rowland. This is Wednesday Talk Radio, where I talk about uncomfortable subjects and how to address them. So my question still stands. So what could we do here in Portland and Oregon, the Pacific Northwest, to really take things up to another level? You know, I don't know exactly what they would be. I was musing on the interesting possibilities of what might happen if people were to simultaneously occupy a whole bunch of branches of, you know, why pick just Chase Bank? They are the biggest funder of fossil fuels, but certainly Bank of America, Wells Fargo, many, many others. Those are three of the top five, I believe. You know, the Occupy movement was a really powerful moment. You know, I'm sure many of you listening either participated directly or were fellow travelers, as they say, or certainly observed it. I mean, some of you might be too young to really have strong memories of that, but, you know, that really did bring up the issue of the control of financial institutions over so much. You know, and this is, you know, this is like about as intersectional an analysis as you can get, because the, you know, if you talk about distorting the social fabric and the natural world and even our ability to confront what's happening, the financial institutions really have a huge share of responsibility. They lock up vast amounts of capital. They invest it in the worst possible ways. They have immense political power. And they just usually get off scot-free like they did after the crash of 2008. And so, you know, Occupy really brought that to the fore, the need to really allow the possibility of, you know, a tax on a speculation tax, for example, a tax on stock trading, just something really simple like that, which, you know, still seems out of our reach. So many things seems out of our reach, but a few things seem a little closer because of the kind of large-scale activism that people have involved in. You know, the shutting down of the Keystone at KXL pipeline was unheard of 10 years ago, 5 years ago. That happened. The Dakota Access Pipeline, I believe, shouldn't actually be operating, but they're continuing to operate against court order. You know, these people, you know, our guest, our caller talked about this heinous trying to buy off this farmer who was valiantly resisting the expropriation of land through eminent domain for the Dakota Access Pipeline. They can, you know, they seem to have relative impunity. So how do we attack that? What could we do that would truly make, you know, even just symbolically to really inspire people? What could we do? And what are the most powerful collective actions you've been involved in? A couple questions, because, you know, really, it's just individual. We've been so fragmented and individualized in the society. That's the, you know, part of the big problem. The working class power that was able to rock the capitalist world a century ago, and, you know, other times, has really lost a lot of its unity and its strength over the years and decades. And, you know, consumer culture, the society, the spectacle, has fragmented us and created these little worlds in our heads that make it difficult for us to even, you know, to relate to lots of other people and to even to have collective spaces to organize in that don't cost a bunch of money. These are all big obstacles. But yeah, as our first caller, Sherry, did say that, you know, it is a moment of solidarity and empowerment, these protests. You know, that's not to be discounted. You know, the main thing they should be for is to actually, you know, stop what's happening, shut things down. But they are moments of collective meeting, and we do need more of them, especially as we emerge from this year and a half long, strange dampening of our social instincts because of this pandemic. Anyway, I could keep talking and read from some of these articles. I'd like to hear what you have to say. 503-231-8187. What are some ideas, you know, what are some ideas you've had? You can even be anonymous and say what you want on the air, that as long as it's not, advocating violence against people or things like that. Let's see. I was going to talk about a scourge of the earth. Grasshopper swarms overwhelm the U.S. West, as if we didn't have enough biblical plagues afflicting us. But this is the kind of thing that, you know, climate change is the kind of impacts it's going to have are just, if you read the details of a lot of the scientific reports, you'll get into some of the nitty-gritty, because they are able to really predict, to model, you know, a lot of the impacts that are going to play out. But you know, they're arriving in swarms so dense it can appear the Earth is moving. They're covering roads and fields, pelting ATV riders, not a bad thing, and steadily devouring grains and grass to the bewilderment of farmers and ranchers. A massive population of grasshoppers is proliferating in the sweltering American West, where a deep drought has made for ideal conditions for grasshopper eggs to hatch and survive into adulthood. This is an article in The Guardian, came out on Sunday, 4th of July. So yeah, it's grim and getting grimmer. Okay, all of a sudden we got the switchboard lighted up. Who's our first caller there, Sonia? Oh, Sonia's still talking to the third caller in her. At 503-231-8187 is the number to call in. I think Edie's ready. Looks like it's Edie. Go ahead, Edie. Good to hear from you.
Hi. Answer your question, what can we do locally? I think both are individual actions, not because collectively it outweighs fracking, logging, mining, military, and the meat industry, but because it helps heal us by living with integrity, and then we overcome a sense of helplessness and despair. We have more self-respect and solidarity with others, and then that empowers us to do more. And so we can get out of denial and then have the energy to work on the bigger things. At the same time, we can meet with other folks, build a sense of community of realistic hope and compassionate creativity instead of despair, as we work on getting out of capitalism. You know, as you said, move your money from the banks to the community credit unions, but also leveraging on those more strategically. Ted Wheeler does not do what we want. Dan Ryan does not do what we want. Amanda Fritz did not. By having large protests, they become even more closed-minded to us. But if we can leverage on those that leverage them with the big money, or deal with the things that does influence them. But meanwhile, in Portland, we could be using the thoroughfares along the highways and railways to be growing hemp that would cool and clean the air and provide fiber for the personal protective gowns and masks that we need to have. We could be growing food and fiber and fuel and habitat on almost every roof, eaves, and wall surface. We could be reusing our paved parking lots with rolling angled shelves that grow plants. And you know, if you're going to have a wedding or something where that church parking lot or whatever is going to be more used, you just roll them aside. But the rest of the time, they're growing food, they're cooling the atmosphere, and they're shading the pavement. We could be working more at having these tiny house villages. We could be taking over the golf courses. The spring, the city council gave an additional $20 million on top of all the other millions of dollars they were giving to a white managed company to manage two golf courses in East Portland on top of all the money we're already spending to add pesticides and keep out the public and destroy the ecosystem. That could become additional showers and restrooms with eco-villages, democratically self-governed, and we could have community gardens, and we could have exercise artwork for understanding our indigenous and our multicultural environment, and restore place while preparing for the almost everybody being houseless between the massive earthquakes, fires, and explosions. We could be taking over Venus and preventing the oil trains coming through to be destroying Portland and the area. So there's things that we can do at all levels of individual and collective action, going against the major corporate military, you know, policing, fossil fuel complex, while we create our own self-sustaining community with our food, our air, our water, our small, localized, diversitized, democratized, small energy development and conservation.
Well,
and
thrown...
I think talking on the radio does make a difference. It creates hope and community and inspiration, and we need that too.
You threw out a lot of things there. I can't remember every single one. I can't remember that I disagreed with any single one. There's certainly things that are sure. And of course, you realize as well as I do that each one of those requires people getting together, people struggling basically to, you know, whether it's to actually acquire the land or get permission to use the land along the freeways or where, whatever it is you're talking about. Every single one of those is, you know, isn't a large organizing job. And obviously, you know, we all know how without to be negative, but how, you know, these things are take time and effort and resources and stuff. And so I don't disagree. I still think that none of those and even all those together aren't going to actually challenge the system in the way that the system needs to be challenged in such a quick period of time. And we've been saying this for, you know, for decades. Oh, we have 10, 15 years, we have 20 years, we have 5 years. You know, we don't have any time. It's got to... And I'm frankly somewhat pessimistic about our ability to do it. But yeah, I keep on harping on the time factor because, you know, this heat dome, this thing was like what people might have thought was going to happen, you know, in 50 years or 30 years or whatever. These things are, you know, you see it, you know it. I guess I'm talking about, you know, okay, let me just tell you a story, Edie, and I'll tell everybody on the radio. Looks like we got Thomas waiting. But let me just tell the story of the most powerful collective actions I've been involved in. I talked about, you know, the rise of the forest protection movement. I could tell that story about how it developed, but I was involved in a struggle against a high-speed train in northwest Italy when I was living there. Oh, God, it's about 20 years ago now. And it was a thing similar to the other movements I've been involved in. I'm sure you've been involved in, Edie, and other people. There's started with just a handful of people organizing against this. You know, people didn't even know where it was going to be exactly in the valley. It was through this valley. It was going to connect the high-speed train system in Italy to the high-speed train system in France. And it was going to devastate this valley. It was going to, you know, it's already had two train lines, a high, big freeway and several roads. And, you know, it was populated. Is just going to devastate that area. And the high-speed train network in Italy was totally unnecessarily, totally devastating, totally connected to the mafia, to just devastating the countryside. I could go into all that. But anyway, so they rose up, and within just a few years, they basically organized most of the valley against it to the point that when they came to expropriate the land from the landowners to start the entrance to the tunnel to go through the mountains, there is a, who knows how many people, 50,000, 100,000 people came from all over Italy, the whole valleys, nearby valleys. I was like two valleys away, and shut down the site. And it took them 5 years. They ended up, you know, coming back because they always come back. They regroup. They had to totally redesign the thing to put it through a different part of the valley. But, you know, it I've never seen a huge infrastructure program shut down on the spot by people power. That's what the kind of thing I'm talking about. And of course, that takes, you know, major organizing. So, yeah, I'm looking for things like that, I guess. I think we need, that's why the Dakota Access pipeline struggle was just so incredible. I was there briefly. It was a similar thing. It was even bigger, actually. And it brought together so many different elements, you know, foremost of which was the indigenous people leading it. But yeah, we need those kind of large scale actions, larger scale than we've been involved in. We need different. We have to keep. That's the thing about organizing and social change. We can't keep doing the same actions in the same way. We have to keep reinventing ourselves. Anyway, I'll stop there and give you the last word and move on to our next callers.
do need to be strategic what do what works, but we have shut down 16 major fossil fuel projects on the West Coast.
Oh, I know. But it's still not enough. We need to do something that resonates even more. We need to do something that I think that challenges the heart of the capitalist system, is why I keep talking about the bank. So I don't know. But thank you,
Edie. Yeah, you're right. I'm just trying to say you are right, and let's not despair, because as right as you are about the time frame, and I've been telling people this for over half a century, we don't act if we have no hope. And we need to be strategic so that the energy we do invest is effective. And
right on.
It's effective on multiple things.
Total agreement. And always good to hear from you, and always inspired by you. And sounds like you're possibly inspired by me. If so, great. Thank you, Edie. It looks like if Thomas is still there, Thomas is up next.
I'm still here. Are you there?
Yep. Go ahead.
Okay. Hey, listen, you were talking about timing, you know, and how we don't have any time. And, you know, the time is now and all that sort of thing. And, you know, it makes me think of this supposedly fact that I hear from environmentalists and a fellow named Guy McPherson and other environmentalists, that there are about 60 tipping points that are positive tipping points out there that are tipping. They're getting worse, and it's going to get worse and worse because of these tipping points, and they're not things that can be reversed. They've gone to that point where they're going to contribute a lot of real big problems to the climate. Plus, we have the baked-in dirt gases, greenhouse gases that are in the environment that have their effect for about 40 years. It takes 40 years for that stuff to work its way through, do its damage, and then possibly be at the end of that cycle, so that if we cut off everything today, cut off all the emissions today, that it would still, the problems would still last for 40 years. So, I mean, this makes it sound hopeless, you know, and I know people want hope. They have to have their hope. But to me, you know, just being hopeful, and I know I hear the action. People are taking action, and that's good. But people...
So what actions do you believe in taking action?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, my question was, what could we do in a short, you know, in the near term, medium term, in Portland, in Oregon, wherever, that would really, really resonate? What sort of actions could we take?
Well, to me, just for me, my personality, Thomas, that to me, that sounds too overwhelming. That's for somebody else to organize, not me. But I'm just telling you about me. That's all. I'm not saying that's how other people should feel. What I try to do, what I think of when I think of something that I can do immediately, it's my consumption habits. I can do that today. You know, and to me, a good example of that is to cut back eating animal products and that sort of thing.
Okay,
but
well,
I know that
that's a lot. That's same kind of things other people have suggested, and it all taken. But I think the thing is, it's not overwhelming if we actually do them together, and so I think that's where the thing is launching ourselves into a space that might be a little uncomfortable, might feel a little, you know, uncertain about what, you know, whether it's going to have an impact or whatever. But I'm just looking for ideas right now of what sort of things could be. Anyway, we got a couple callers, and we got only like six, seven minutes left. So I got to let you go. Appreciate you calling. Let's go to Tim next. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm just following up on some of the people's other comments. I do believe in social change, and that it's possible. I've worked in it all my life. And I think one way, if you don't want to have blood or minimize the amount of blood spilled, and the way to do it is to create the alternative within the existing system and have it grow and erode the system, so that we eventually replace it.
So you think within the time frame that climate change is coming at us, that's actually going to stem climate change?
What I think might help. Okay, I'm an old hippie. I used to help set up communes and things like that, and I studied social change and creating it. I think the tribal model of organization adapted to multicultural, multiracial base would be a way for us to organize independent of the government, increase our power, and be
especially
able to,
if they're taking direct actions to shut down the capitalist system. Yeah.
Yeah, and that way you mobilize the whole tribe, and if you can create a basic land base, right, so that you can provide your basic food and necessities, then have a rural base also, so you can be there for demonstrations, to take advantage of education, music, social life, whatever, then that covers it both. And as a tribe, if people contribute their resources together, you're going to have buku money, right, to work with, to set up systems where you can have pure air, pure water, things like that. Because if it's true that we're screwed and there's not much we can do to change it, then we need to adapt to it. If we can't leave the planet, we're going to have to adapt or die. And a tribal model will give us the resources to do that. And if it's successful, if it's replicatable, as soon as people see it working, I suspect that many other groups will try to do the same thing.
Okay.
And so that's one way I see out of it. The other way would be build some ships and get the heck off this planet.
Yeah, well, there are big capitalists who are actually doing that. They're vying with each other.
Yeah.
They're even saying that they're going to go up in their rocket ships. Well, I don't wish that their rocket ships explode necessarily, but, you know. Anyway, yeah.
We need it so that the people have ships. The people are in control. I mean, common working people with specialists to fly the ships, of course.
Yeah, well, we're veering into the kind of science fiction that I think is...
That's possible, brother.
Yeah,
it's
maybe.
Possible.
Well, okay.
We have the technology.
Okay, thanks, Tim.
We need the political will.
Okay, well, yeah. Why do people throw these huge things into the works at the very end of the show? The whole issue of, you know, colonizing other planets and such as a way to, you know, I don't know, we'll just spread the Homo sapiens inability to deal with its own contradictions, just spreading it to the rest of the universe is my basic view on that. But that's a big subject. Yeah, I don't know. I can't necessarily disagree with the root of what Tim was saying, which is, you know, small-scale, tight-knit group organizing in the face of... But, you know, it's got to happen on a, you know, in neighborhoods, in communities. And the whole idea of using the word tribe, I find somewhat problematic given, you know, our Euro-American problematic relationship with the tribal kinship societies that... have inhabited this continent and this area for so long. But it looks like we got one more caller. Arthur, you have like 1 minute to get what you got to say in. Go ahead, Arthur. Oh, Arthur?
No.
Okay. Well, we're at 8:57 in the morning. We have to wrap this show up. Well, this has been interesting. I keep on, you know, I feel like I have to just keep pushing this whole issue of what are we actually facing? You know, how fast is climate change really happening? Can we try to come to grips with that? What are the possibilities of action in the face of it? Who is responsible? Who do we target? What are some of the actions we could take that would truly resonate? So yeah, those are some of the questions I pose. I'm sure you've got your questions. I appreciate your listening. I appreciate everybody who called in. Thank you, Sonia, for operating the boards. And I'll talk with you next week. Should have Jacqueline Keeler as my second Wednesday co-host. See ya.
Give me Stalin and St. Paul. Give me Christ or give me Hiroshima. Another fetus, and now we don't like children anyhow. We've seen the future, baby. It is murder. Yeah, things are gonna slide.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, also heard at translator K220HR Hood River at 91.9 FM, and translator K282BH in